Ian Tattersall is our guest here on the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell was helping me get used to this word that is not adaptation, but
exaptation.
And, tell me what that means, please.
Well, exaptation is a notion, or not so much a notion, but as a term that was relatively recently coined to describe features which arise in a different context from those in which they are later co-opted. Adaptations seem to be, you know, the notion of adaptation is part of this fine-tuning idea of evolution. And in fact, if you think about it, any new feature, any genetic novelty has to arise before it can have a function, before it can be an adaptation. And this is this terminology, this notion of exaptation, is a way of accommodating to this. Any new feature arises before it can assume any function, whatever.
This seems to be real, very central in understanding what I think most of us are most interested in, and that is the origins of humans as we know humans. Mm-hmm. For example, you and I think most people would say that language symbolic manipulation is right at the heart of what makes humans humans and distinguishes us from others. But the brain was there well before the language, apparently, which goes to what you're talking about, but it is it's a stretch for those of us that don't spend our days thinking about it.
That's exactly it. I mean, you really have put your finger on the real problem of explaining, you know, how we came to be the way that we are. But it's an old process, this exaptation. Birds had feathers as part of their temperature control system, keeping the body warm long, long, long before they ever used those feathers to fly. And yet now we think of flight as being the defining characteristic of feathers. This is true, I think, of many aspects of humans, too. For example, you know, speech is a very common, is very commonly regarded as being sort of the thing that released human consciousness. Somebody invented speech. They cannot have invented speech without a brain that was capable of producing the symbolism that lies underneath speech. And you couldn't have speech without the mechanisms that allow us to produce the sounds. Now, we know that those mechanisms in the throat, the structure of the upper respiratory tract, go back probably 600,000 years at least. But nobody is suggesting, on the basis of what we know of behavior in the fossil record, that humans were actually speaking, that humans actually had language 600,000 years ago. But they had a mechanism that was an essential prerequisite.
This takes us back, it seems, to that mystery that you were referring to early on, that the biology and the culture, I guess I put it that way, perhaps you can fine-tune that for me.
But anatomy and behavior.
Isn't that some of this great challenge of the timing of, is it a biological human, is it what we would recognize as a human?
Well, that's the $64,000 question that you've raised right there. Yes, humans look the way that they look today, at least 100,000 years ago, but they didn't start behaving or didn't start showing any evidence of symbolic behaviors, which, you know, most of us think is really where the big difference between humans and every other organism in the world.
And those are the things you find in the archaeological record, right?
Those are things you find in the archaeological record. The archaeological record is the evidence of human behavior that's been left behind. And until about 40 to 60,000 years ago, The evidence is that human behavior was fairly straightforward and fairly simple. The complexities suddenly came in this 60,000 to 40,000 year old period. And that is a point that I think we can be fairly confident that human consciousness as we know it today became established.
For a long time, the man was defined as the toolmaker. And I think most people, if you went out on the sidewalks of New York and asked people, I think tools would be right at the heart of what they would describe as human. And yet the archaeological record, the physical record, suggests that tools come much, 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 much earlier than the language, which you characterize, I think, is what really distinguishes human behavior, modern human behavior. Yeah.
That's absolutely right. You know, we value tools because we could no longer live without them. You know, we could no longer be human if we didn't have tools available to use. On the other hand, you know, when we think of tools today, we think of a very, very complex set of devices which aid us in our life and as sort of extensions of ourselves. But the very first tools go back to about 2.5 million years ago.
That's a long time.
That's a very long time, and the tools themselves were relatively crude, or we would think of them as being crude, because they're just small, sharp flakes, chips, that are knocked off rocks and are used to cut things. Now, this sounds like a fairly rudimentary kind of kind of equipment, little stone flakes, but they're remarkably effective. With experimental archaeologists have dismembered entire elephants using little inch, 2 inch long flakes of half sharp stone. What's more, it takes quite a bit of insight to make those little flakes. Anybody who's ever tried to make stone tools knows that it is not a simple kind of a thing to do.
You end up with blue fingers.
Absolutely, or red fingers, you know. It's,
another tool that isn't a rock, but you make the point that just dazzled me, that it may well be that hominids who became humans, I probably didn't say that right, left Africa before they had fire, which I think of as a fundamental tool. I mean, for me, fire is just, fire is kind of it for me. Now, I'm just me. But again, this business of the physiological and the, if you will, cultural, that they don't happen simultaneously, that goes against all the alley-oop things I was raised on, all of the cartoons, all really, in a way, all of the novels that have been written to try to make this personal for us. The idea that the physiology and the tools, whatever kind of tool, are not necessarily happening at the same time.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The notion of improvement that we've already talked about sort of implies a relatively constant rate of change in our past, both behaviorally and in terms of our anatomy. And we know that this isn't the case. Just from looking at our fossil record and our archaeological record, you know, human evolutionary history has been likened to the life of a soldier, you know, with huge periods of boredom punctuated by brief moments of terror. And that's essentially
human.
Right.
This is punctuated disequilibrium.
Exactly. Exactly. Innovation has been relatively rare and episodic in human evolution. We don't see this fine-tuning thing that I keep coming back to. What we see is a long period of no change, and then suddenly something new comes in. And if it's successful, it gets incorporated into the repertoire, whether it's anatomical repertoire or behavioral, and is the building block for whatever is going to happen next. And of course, there's never any guarantee that anything at all is going to happen next.
The obvious question is, what changed? Well, you see the physical evidence in the tools as an example, mm-hmm. and just instantly, I think all of us would say, okay, what happened? You know, what happened to humans that made that change possible?
That is another imponderable, I'm afraid to say. Making stone tools, even very rudimentary stone tools, is something that is not that easy to do, and that nobody has been able to, for example, teach an ape to do. Even with very, very extensive coaching, no ape has really gotten the idea of hitting one piece of rock with another at exactly the right angle that's necessary to detach a sharp flake. We also know that these early tool makers 2.5 million years ago showed insight into the necessity to plan ahead and to make tools. What they would do, apparently, is carry lumps of suitable rock around with them in anticipation of needing them, because they wouldn't they would know that you wouldn't get the right kind of rock necessarily at the point where you needed it. So there's a lot of archaeological sites where archaeologists have been able to piece together complete cobbles from the flakes that the early hominids made in the process of tool making. So they used to carry these things for several kilometers around with them, in the knowledge that they were going to need them. And that's a kind of foresight that we don't really find too well expressed among apes either.
This is Ian Tattersall. Bill Russell and I will be back in just a moment with him as we continue our conversation from the American Museum of Natural History. Please join us.